Part of the polarization in our politics is evident in what news outlets we choose to follow or trust. Some only listen to NPR and read the New York Times. Others never change the TV channel away from Fox News or MSNBC. If that's reality, then what responsibility do those networks and newspapers have to not only present facts, but also help viewers, listeners, and readers understand what's going on with our national institutions and branches of government? Earlier this month, David Leonhardt of the New York Times and Ramesh Panuvuru of National Review spoke about some of those issues at an event put together by ASU School of Civic and Economic Thought and Leadership. I spoke with them before that event at ASU's Tempe campus. I started by asking Leonhardt where social media fits in when it comes to helping civic literacy.
I do think social media has real strengths. I mean, I think the classic example, and it's a little cliche to this point, but I also think it's true, is the lonely teenager, right? Who, you know, the only conservative in a small college town, a gay student in a town where he thinks he's the only gay student, no doubt he's not. And this idea that the world is more connected than it used to be, that knowledge and interaction is more available, I think is really beneficial, but it clearly comes with enormous downsides. And I think one of the biggest downs, like Ramesh, I use it. I particularly enjoy it as a form of curation. Mm-hmm. I now think that, look, if there is a really good article, I'm going to see it because someone I follow will tweet about it. And if there's a criticism of a piece I write, I will learn about it there. But there's much that's damaging about social media, and particularly the kind of spiral of mm-hmm. anger. And I guess my quick bit of advice would be just always remember you're dealing with human beings. Right? And you're not just dealing with two-dimensional photos of people, and treat people decently.
Well, I'm sure we've all gotten those letters, emails saying, you're a terrible person, I can't stand you. And then if you actually get back to people, most of them will say, oh, I didn't really realize there was someone out there. Okay, thank you for responding to me.
What I don't understand is the people who will send you the 9 paragraphs emails that begin with personal abuse. You do wonder whether this mode of communication
that, right? Yes.
really works for them in general.
So let's discuss the media's role generally in, I'm going to say, again, understanding our institutions, or if President Trump gets criticized for this quite a bit, about picking institutions apart bit by bit that maybe needed some picking apart, but maybe not the way he does it. Is there something to whether media outlets have a responsibility to not disagree with the administration, but to sort of straighten people out on certain things?
Well, I think that the key civic role that the media plays is by reporting accurately on stories, and especially the most important stories, and everything else that they do socially is a byproduct of that. And it has to be done without fear or favor. Mm. I think it's particularly difficult in a moment when you've got a president and an administration that is using you as a foil. It will seize on actual examples of journalistic error to try to discredit the entire enterprise of journalism. And I don't know if anybody has quite identified a way to respond to that effectively.
I was talking to a journalist the other day who said, look, we're fallible. And when we got something wrong during the Obama administration or the George W. Bush administration, we would hear from the people in the administration, and they wouldn't be happy, and they wouldn't pretend to be happy. And I got those calls as well, as both a reporter and an editor. They were often quite aggressive. Sometimes it even verged into inappropriate aggression. But they always wanted you to get the story right. Even when you emerge thinking they're wrong about what they wanted, sometimes you emerge thinking they're right, we messed up. Sometimes you emerge thinking they're wrong, they're just sort of lobbying the ref. They wanted you to get the story right. And with the Trump administration, it feels different. It feels like they just want to discredit the media, and they are almost happier when the media makes mistakes, because they don't even necessarily go to the media to ask for a correction. They just immediately go public and try to use it to paint the media as being in bad faith.
David, is it working from the standpoint of the Trump administration to have enough people lost faith generally in media or gone into their camps of, you know, we always put Fox News and MSNBC, those are always the easiest examples. Has there been a strategy to that that has ultimately worked among the American people that more are cynical about what they read or what they see?
I think it's half worked. I think it's been very damaging for society. I think it's hurt the media somewhat, but I also think it's hurt Trump. And if you look at the percentage of Americans who believe him, who approve of his performance, I don't actually think it's working that well for him.
Mm-hmm. Polls do suggest that people believe more of what they read in the press than they believe from President Trump. But so much of what the Trump administration is doing is a political strategy that has to be evaluated in different terms than we have normally used, because the strategy is entirely about maintaining the base of support and not at all about reaching out to persuadable voters. And as long as he succeeds in maintaining that base, there are some important political goals that he achieves, such as staving off impeachment.
Mm-hmm. Now, has he alienated enough people, though, who are those who may have wanted to find that middle ground and they're just sort of throwing up their hands at this point, like, call me again in a year and a half?
So this is really a question about the next election. And I think that it's likely that the Trump campaign strategy will be a primarily negative strategy against whoever the Democrats nominate, and that that is the most effective strategy they've got available to them to make the campaign not so much a referendum on the incumbent as a choice between the candidates, and say to some people, look, you may not like me, you may not love everything about me, but the alternative is, for various reasons, unacceptable. And that's essentially what how they won in 2016, when you had overlapping majorities of the public who considered both of the leading candidates unacceptable, and he won going away with the people who disliked both of them.
And I'd add that while I think Trump's an underdog in 2020, it did work in 2016, and I think there's an aspect of it that is going to work again, which is, we don't know where this Ukraine story and impeachment are going to go, but right now I think the basic assumption we should have is that the vast majority of Republican voters will stick by Trump. And Ramesh, you may disagree with this, but that there will be a sort of narrative about why they would have been okay with a different Democrat, but they're not okay with whoever the nominee is. If it's Warren, that's kind of obvious what it will be, but I think we'll even get it if it's Biden. Because Hillary Clinton was not a socialist, but we got it with her. And so I think Trump understands that although conservative intellectuals like Ramesh will not bend to his will, much of the Republican Party will bend to his will, and that's part of what the base maintenance strategy is about.
The line has been blurred for quite a while in what I do and in television, as far as that reporter pundit.
Yeah.
Or commentator. And it seems that maybe a lot of the public doesn't quite get it or doesn't want to get it. Has that been an issue, you think, in terms of dividing people more into their camps when they decide that, well, this person in the New York Times said this, and you say, well, that was a column, that wasn't a report?
The thing that I like to think about history with this, if you are an American today, you think of the norm as having mainstream media have this standard of objectivity. Not that it necessarily lives up to it, but that it aspires to it, whether it's the Wall Street Journal or NPR or the New York Times or the Arizona Republic. And we think that's normal, but it's actually not normal. For most of American history, we have had ideological media, even partisan media. It's why if you travel around the country, you'll still find newspapers that have Republican or Democrat in the name. If you've seen the show Hamilton, you understand that this idea of kind of an ideological media was the norm at the country's founding through much of the 19th century. It's still the norm in much of the world. And so I do think there are some downsides to some of this blurring, but I think there are also downsides to the traditional, the modern American model. And I don't think people should think that this notion of we've got reporters who have no opinions or who hide them, and then we've got pundits who are off screaming about things and they're totally separate. That's not either the geographic or the historical norm, and both models have pluses and minuses.
One thing that I think is worth a lot of effort is to have the idea of opinion journalism as something that does not just mean that there are no standards. So, everybody has opinions, right? But we should be encouraging opinion journalism that is accurate, that is factual, that uses arguments and is conducted in a civil and an intelligent way. Doesn't mean there won't be forceful things, doesn't mean there won't be incendiary things said, but I do think we have to maintain this idea that it's not just that sort of, well, there's sort of non-opinion journalism, and then it's just sort of, no standards whatsoever.
Ramesh Panuru of National Review and David Leonhardt of the New York Times. I spoke with them last week at ASU's Tempe campus.